Hello and welcome to our Christmas gifts edition of Mooney Goes Wild. Tonight, we're going to take you on a journey through nature's pages and explore the captivating world of wildlife through books. We begin our journey with Éin and Ileana.
Hello, Derek. My Christmas choice is not for the faint-hearted.
Oh, indeed.
The book is like a doorstop. It's got 750 pages in it, and it's called Ireland's Generous Nature by Peter Wise-Jackson. And it's the book of everything, every plant in Ireland, and ones that were brought here as well, and what they were used for all through the ages, what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, the medicines, all of those. Now, I have to give you a health warning, because there are loads of cures for piles and warts and you would not like to be doing it because you probably kill yourself in the process. I mean, some of these things are ridiculous cures. So do not eat anything. Do not take anything out of this book.
Do not try this at home.
Do not try. Read the book at home, but, you know, if you don't know that it's safe before you read the book, don't take the book's advice. And in fact, Peter, to be fair to him, at the beginning of the book says, do not try this at home.
Okay, good.
But it's now, great. It's full of all sorts of exciting things.
And it's massive, Éin. It's massive. Drop it on the table there, Éin, so people can hear just how massive it is. Boom. Now, the table's almost collapsed. Now, who is Peter Wise-Jackson?
Peter Wise-Jackson was originally the director of the Botanic Gardens in Dublin. And then he went off to become the president of Missouri Botanic Gardens. And he's just retired from there now. And he spent his life, obviously, writing this book. And he got Missouri Botanic Gardens to publish it, all 750 pages of it. And therefore, it's available on Amazon rather than in a bookshop. Now, I got it when it came out in 2014. And I've been mining it for all kinds of information and treasure. And all I sound really wonderful when I tell you about plants, but half of it has come out of this book in the first place, I have to confess.
Now, you spoke to Peter from his home in Missouri.
Actually, I spoke to him from the Botanic Gardens in Missouri, where now he is president. Peter, how long did it take you to write this book?
Éine, it took me probably 10 years of actual writing, but about 50 years of preparation to do it. Because I've been interested in the use of Irish plants, really, most of my life. And so this was an attempt to gather any information I could find on pretty well every plant in Ireland. It documents about 1,500 different plant species and what's known about their use for multitude of different purposes throughout history in Ireland.
So it's not just merely curing people or putting spells on them, but I mean other things like making ropes, like making musical instruments, like being used for thatching, all of these things that they were used for as well. So it's a lifetime's craft, really, all there together. And no matter what plant you might think of, you look it up and there it is, because obviously with 1,500 plants in it, there are far more than just the native Irish species, the ones that came here of their own bat and weren't brought here by other people. So there's ones that were planted for various reasons, ones that turned up as invasive species, all sorts of things, and you have an account of them all.
Well, I've tried to make sure that I get as much information as I could find on really every plant that occurs in the wild in Ireland that has been used for some purpose in Ireland over the years. And many wild plants that are not native were brought in specifically because they were used for food or medicine or some other purpose.
The bit I find really interesting is the use of plants for medicines. I mean, you look at what they were used for. You'd wonder how people didn't die by taking the cures rather than whatever ailed them in the first instance. All sorts of things that we wouldn't dream of eating nowadays because we know they're not good for us.
Well, I think they also had many centuries of trial and error. There is between a quarter and a third of all of the wild Irish plants were probably used for some medicinal purpose in the past. But today, most of that is forgotten. There are some people who remember, who have cures for different things. But a lot of that knowledge is now gone. It was believed that for every ailment, there was a plant cure in Ireland. But that traditional knowledge of how they were used for medicinal purposes has, by and large, gone from popular knowledge.
I suppose, like anything else, it depends on if you believe it or not. I mean, if you believe something is doing you good, well, then it probably is doing you good. I mean, the wild orchids, I mean, the Irish word for those are magerlín, magerlín na cuaica, or magerlín and spidoiga, in other words, the testicles of these various creatures. And so if you had recourse for that, if you were a man, well, you might feel that it was going to enhance your love life somewhat if you were to drink it or take part of eating it or something like that.
You're absolutely right. But I think you can really divide the medicinal uses of plants into two different categories, those that actually do work and those where you believe they will help, which can give you a boost as well.
Yes, speak to me of pissy beds, of Taraxacum officinalis, the dandelion. Now, that one does work, obviously, as a diuretic. But you found many other uses for dandelion as well, did you not?
Dandelions are wonderful plants. In the spring, occasionally I'll put a bucket over the leaves and they come up less green than if you had them uncovered. And then you can take the leaves and use them as salad, because they're not as bitter as when they're dark green. You can take the flowers and boil them and add sugar, and you can make your own wildflower honey. You can roast the roots to make a decaffeinated coffee. You can dip the flowers in batter and make fritters with them. So it's an altogether useful plant.
Another one that was quite commonly used were buttercups for treatments of various ailments, including such things as warts, heartburn, kidney trouble, mumps, swollen glands and jaundice. Now, what on earth connection has warts got with jaundice, for example? How can this be a cure-all for all of these things?
Well, it may not have been a cure-all for all of them. It may have been used, but it doesn't necessarily demonstrate that it actually cured those ailments. The connection between jaundice and buttercups would be because, a bit like the doctrine of signatures, where if something resembles the shape or the colour of a symptom of a disease, then perhaps that plant would be used as a hint that the good Lord would have given us that that plant could be used for a cure. So jaundice leads to a yellowing of the skin. The buttercup is yellow.
So this was a clue. God was saying, this is a clue. You're yellow. The buttercup is yellow. The buttercup will fix you. Indeed. So then you wouldn't want to be trying it with a dandelion, or you wouldn't want to be trying it with some other yellow flower. You had to know which one it was. You've pages and pages here on the hawthorn tree. Now, the hawthorn tree was the one we had this year for National Tree Day, which is not long over. And there's an enormous amount of association with the hawthorn tree, not only with eating it, but with magic as well, and the magic of the tree. And people firmly believed that this was a tree that if you brought it into the house, bad luck would follow. I wonder how that got associated with the hawthorn tree, when you have things like, say, the rowan tree, the mountain ash, which is a magic tree as well, but it's a good magic tree rather than a bad magic tree, if you like.
The hawthorn tree certainly has a lot of rich folklore associated with it. Single hawthorn trees out in the middle of a field may be regarded as being a tree around which the fairies would gather, and no one would want to cut it down at the risk of upsetting them. If you take a sprig of hawthorn into the house, it has a funny smell, which has been compared with an aroma that could be associated with death. And I suspect that's one of the reasons why people don't want to bring those flowers into the house. It will be bringing death into the house. It will be bad luck.
I'm looking here at what you say about holly, because holly is brought into the house still, and people will actually go out and get holly, put it in their holly wreaths, bring them in. And you're saying that this is actually going back very many centuries to when people saw these things alive in the winter time. Everything else had no leaves, everything else was dead. So holly and ivy were ones that still had life in them. So they were bringing them in to celebrate the sun god Lu, practically. I mean, it's a pagan thing that we still do. It goes back as far as that.
I think it's certainly a case that evergreen branches were brought in as a a reassurance that that spring is coming and that most of the plants will spring back into life again and produce their leaves. But the evergreens are everlasting, and there is a sense of the continuity of life that in the winter that these ivy and holly and yew and other evergreens does bring.
Thank you, Aina and Peter Wise Jackson. And just to remind you that the details of all the books mentioned on tonight's programme can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Eric Dempsey, what have you got for us?
Well, my book is a book called Meetings with Moths by Cathy Baird. Now, Cathy lives in Scotland and she is one of Scotland's moth experts. Mm-hmm. And this book is a beautifully written book. It talks about the life cycles of moths, the camouflage, how they defend themselves, the caterpillars. Everything you ever need to know about moths is written in this book. And it's written in just such a lovely, easy way that you don't realise you're learning until you've closed the book and you go, wow, that was amazing.
Now, it's pronounced Catty with two T's and no H, K-A-T-T-Y. And you spoke with her recently.
I did, Derek. And I began by asking her why she wrote this book.
The main thing I was hoping to achieve is just to share my sort of enthusiasm and joy of moths and to get across that these beautiful insects occur everywhere, wherever you are. So you don't, quite often you read about natural history sort of quests where people are off searching for rarities in all corners of the world or all corners of the UK, but you don't need to travel to see beautiful species. And just learning more about them, getting to know your own countryside, your local habitats and seeing the moths there is something that I really want to encourage. And then I suppose also that I'm a scientist by training, so I wanted to try and weave a little bit of the science of, you know, the ecology and the natural history of these insects into the narrative as well, but not make it too heavy on the science.
Tell me a little bit about your background with moths and tell me a little bit about the book itself.
Well, I've had a lifelong interest in natural history, so I did it as a child. I was a keen bird watcher and always liked insects. And actually went to study insect at university, and then I did a doctorate in aphids. But it wasn't really until 10 years or so ago that I properly got into moths. So I always knew that these beautiful insects were out there and they existed.
It is a very addictive pastime, I have to say. Like, people said to me, oh, you must get into moths. And as a birder, I'd say, no, I'm not getting interested in moths at all. But I just wonder, anybody tell me what this one might be? And then I got a book, and then I got a moth trap. And I swear to God, it is the most exciting thing because you just don't know what you're going to get every morning. Because you said in your book that opening the trap is like, you know, Christmas morning where you look inside and you don't know what it is. And I think that is the beauty of your book. You actually capture not just a lot of information written in a beautifully easy way to read, but you actually capture the magic of it. Is that the thing that has you hooked on moths? Is it the magic of it, the unpredictability of it?
I don't know. I think there's all sorts of things. So there is definitely that unpredictability. And you know that you're, well, sometimes, very occasionally, I have a trap with absolutely nothing in. But you know that usually you're going to get something. And even when it's a moth you've seen before, they're still lovely. And there's lots of variation within each species. So you can see one that's darker than usual or more boldly coloured than usual. So there's lots of different variety within each individual species. So you never get bored. There's a lot of species around. So in the UK, we have 2,500 different species. They won't all turn up in your light trap, but there's still plenty to keep you going for a whole lifetime and more to be discovering new things all the time. So that excites me. But I also really like getting to know the moth better and learning a little bit more about them and going to look for them, not just in my light trap, but go and look for their caterpillars out feeding on the leaves, or go and look for them by day. Some species fly by day, and just sort of follow them around and learn more about what they get up to during the day and night.
Reading your book, I would class you as a hardcore mother. Would I be right? Because I was reading about you going down into tunnels to look for herals and then finding wintering tissues, which are a wonderful name for a moth. Would you call yourself a hardcore mother?
Well, people sometimes call me an extreme mother, but I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I just do what I like. I think at this time of year, you definitely need to get into the hibernating moth scene. You don't have to go down deep caves or water-filled tunnels. You could just go and look in a garden shed, or if you've got a historic building, which, you know, an unheated old building with dark nooks and crannies, go and shine a torch into the corners there and you may well find a hibernating moth. So they are everywhere, and a really good thing to keep up the moth interest over the winter months when there's not so much on the wing.
Would you tell me a little bit about what you know of the migration of moths? Because that was a revelation to me, because that is something that really might capture the imagination of people.
Moths' migration is absolutely extraordinary and mind-blowing, because these are tiny insects and some of them travel a long, long way. So coming to the UK from North Africa, that sort of distance, you know, it's just incredible that these tiny creatures can reach us here. And it's exciting as well. So you're talking about the unpredictability of what might be in a moth trap in the morning. Well, adding migrant moths to the mix makes it even more unpredictable, because then you've got a whole load of extra species. So where I live on the east coast, southeast coast of Scotland, that's not a bad place for Scotland anyway to receive migrants coming across the North Sea. So we get some really lovely big hawk moths that come in September and October. This year I had a moth called a delicate, which arrived in my moth trap in September. And that was the first time that species had been seen in East Lothian, which is a county where I live. So that was very exciting. They get all these things in the south of England quite often, but it's nice to see them further north. And in Ireland, you'll get a whole load of other exciting species coming your way, particularly in the south.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by one little one that you were talking about, and it's a diamondback moth. And what fascinated me is that you were saying that, like, I knew that they might come up, but I didn't realise they went back to where they came from.
So some of the species will go back again. The diamondback moth is one that is more of a one-way thing. They're seeking out food to feed on. But a lot of our species, the silver wye is perhaps the most well-known, which comes up here in the spring, migrates in the sort of spring and early summer, and then breeds here for a bit. And then there'll be a return movement of individuals in the autumn. So it's not the same moth coming all the way here and then going all the way back again. They do it through different generations of moths, which again is incredible. So the ones that come up north, head north from Europe in the spring, are programmed to head north. And then a different generation, so their offspring or their grandchildren or their great grandchildren in the autumn, will be programmed to head south. So there's some clever genetics and interactions with the environment and day length and temperature and all these things all going on. And there are researchers who have done quite a lot of research into it as well. So, really fascinating.
I have to admit, thinking of you know, moths travelling up from southern Europe or North Africa, and then their generations going back from Ireland or from Scotland, heading back to southern Europe and North Africa, where they would spend the winter, and then the whole thing comes full circle again. Reading that chapter just blew my mind, because I didn't realise that the next generations went back again. And to me, that opens up the whole world of insects, because we think of migrants as things like swallows, but that moths can do that. The other interesting thing is the evolution of moths. You were saying they've been around for millions and millions of years.
Yes. What fascinated me when I was researching this was the way they know how many millions of years ago early moths were, is that people looking in fossil beds, old fossil beds, have found tiny scales. So the wings of moths and butterflies are covered in these tiny, tiny scales. And that's what makes them the group of insects that they are. And these researchers digging around in old fossil beds in Europe came across tiny microscopic scales in amongst the sediments. And that's how they've linked it to when the earliest moths were around.
That's a long time. You know, I've always asked a question of people like yourself. What is your favourite moth and why?
Everyone always asks me that question. And it changes, actually, depending on what I've just seen. But for the winter time, my favourite moth has to be the tissue moth, which I talk about in the book. It's just a beautiful insect. It's quite unusual in Scotland, a bit more common further south in England. but it's just beautiful. It's all this, it's sort of silvery grey, different shades of grey, so sort of slaty coloured and silver coloured, and then these beautiful pink lines and running through it, and a pink fringe. And I come across them. I've never seen one out in the open in a moth trap or anything. I've only ever seen them so far inside caves and mines. And when you're in this dark space with a torch and you shine the torch on the walls and these beautiful moths just appear, it's just magical. And then trying to understand more about their ecology in Scotland as well keeps me occupied during the winter. Haven't got very far yet, but...
Well, Cathy, I think you've achieved everything you set out to with this book. It's a book I think a lot of people will pick up and will really enjoy. I'm going to be reading it myself again over Christmas. Thank you very much, Cathy. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cathy and Eric Dempsey. Terry Flanagan is next. Terry.
Well, Derek, my book is a book on lichens. Or do you say lichens or do you say lichens?
I say lichens, but what do I know?
Well, I'm told that people in Ireland tend to say lichens, whereas people in England tend to say lichens. Personally, I like lichens. Again, is it tomato? Is it tomato? Anyway, that's what my book is. It's on lichens. I've had a fascination for them for many years now. I remember going down to a course down in Waterford to the Biodiversity Data Centre down there on lichens, and I was blown away by it because I never realised that Ireland, it's a hotspot. There's approximately 1,300 different species found throughout the country. And lichen expert Paul Whelan has just recently released The Lichens of Ireland and Great Britain. Now, this is a book for anyone who is in interest or if you want to learn more about these intriguing little creatures. So I travelled down to Middleton in County Cork to meet Paul, to observe some of the local varieties and to chat about his book.
Now, Terry, come over here and have a look at this. God, this is a lovely spot we're in. We're in just outside Middleton in County Cork. Where exactly are we?
We're actually at Saline Creek, a little outlet here, coming in off Cork Harbour.
Now, what we've come down to see are the lichens here. Now, the first one I see here on the wall, I recognise it. That's Xanthoria.
Oh, the famous Xanthoria parotina, yeah. It's probably the most abundant yellow lichen in the country.
And you've recently published a new book on lichens. A fantastic book. Two volumes. Tell me a little bit about it.
Two volumes, over 720 species described. It's taken me 4 years' work. And what makes this book different from basically all the others is that I have included all the techniques for identifying the lichens.
Tell me, what exactly is a lichen?
Well, that's a very simple and complex question at the same time. A lichen really is a lump of fungal tissue with some little green algae growing in them.
So it's a symbiotic relationship.
It's a symbiotic relationship. The algae are photosynthesizing, passing sugars over to the fungi. The fungi are protecting the algae and also keeping it, if you like, attached to the substrate and giving it its own miniature little environment. Mm-hmm.
So your book, it's an ID of all of these lichens, but it's not just about that. It also includes the history of lichens in Ireland.
Okay, I'll go through the book in general terms. From the beginning, we have the basic biology of the lichen, which you have to have an understanding of in order to identify them, because all the descriptions make reference to certain features. That moves on to the ecology of the lichens. Some of them grow in woodlands, some grow in creeks or estuaries like we have here. So that's all described. Lichens are like garden plants. You have some that are sun-loving and some that are shade-loving. So, you know where to look for them. You know what side of a tree a lichen is generally going to be on. So we cover all of that. And then there's a discussion on the history of lichenology. Originally, I was writing just about Ireland, but you can't isolate a country. So I had to return, if you like, to the basis of lichenology in Europe. And really, from just before Linnaeus, the famous Linnaeus who brought in the binomial system, up to the present day. And in fact, talking about the history, we are about 5 kilometres here from where Isaac Carle, an Irish lichenologist in the 1860s, where he lived. And Isaac Carle made a great contribution to lichenology. He was actually a general botanist, a very good general botanist.
You also mention about Matilda Knowles in the book. She was a very famous lichenologist.
Yes, Matilda Knowles was from Belfast, came to work in Dublin, and around 1909 the Clare Island survey was set up, and the idea was to map every single thing, not just living thing, but also all the archaeology and the geology of Clare Island. We also have other Irish lichenologists of note, one of them being Ellen Hutchins. So back to the book there, Terry. In the book, I put in this history of lichenology, both from Europe, for the emergence of the concept of a lichen, to people like Matilda Knowles and Ellen Hutchins. Mm-hmm. So the book is very comprehensive from that point of view.
So who exactly is the book geared towards?
The book is geared towards any amateur naturalist who actually wants to get a grip on lichens.
Because not many people will actually go out and look at lichens. People go out and they'll go bird watching, or they'll go mammal watching or whatever. But we've walked down here, 100 metres or so, and we've seen 10 or 15 different species of lichen. We've watched runners go by. We've watched people walking their dogs. Not one of them paid any attention to them.
Well, yes. The interesting thing about lichens, despite their fabulous range of forms and that, is that their interest lies just below that of what the naked eye can pick up. So really, to look at them, become interested in them, you need a 10x hand lens. Not a higher magnification, maybe a bit lower, but don't go above 10x. And once you put the 10x hand lens down, you're going to see all the various structures that help you to identify them.
And the idea of the book is to stimulate them into getting a hand lens, get out there,
yes,
bring the book with you and have a look for your lichens.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So all the little structures that help you put a name on a lichen are emphasised in the book with little arrows and magnifications. So if anyone takes one of these lichens and is serious about trying to get a name for it, the book will certainly lead you to that.
Lichens, have they any use at all? Most people would look at them and they'd say they're just like dirt growing on a wall or a tree.
That's interesting you say it like that, because Carl Linnaeus himself called them nature's paupers. The interesting thing about Linnaeus is he never used a hand lens or a microscope, even though they were coming into vogue in science at the time.
One thing about the book is the quality of the photographs. They're absolutely stunning. Are they your own?
Most of them are my own, but obviously no one person can photograph them all. There's just so many. And not only that, the photographs I chose from others and from myself were chosen to show particular morphological features, in other words, features of the anatomy that helps you identify them. So to answer your question, most of them are mine, but others are from lichenologists around the world.
This book would certainly make an ideal Christmas present for somebody. But really what you'd need to add to it would be a hand lens.
Absolutely agree, totally. I'd love to have added a hand lens into the book myself, but it would have obviously been too bulky and that. But if somebody is giving it as a present, you must get a 10x hand lens to go with it.
You and really open up a whole new world if you do
totally
that.
Totally new world, as they say, a Lilliputian world. Yeah. The amount of detail you can see at 10x on the lichens is fabulous.
And one thing that's different from, say, bird watching, these lichens, they're not going to get up and run away or fly away. You can stay out in a spot like we are here in Saline Creek in County Cork and just spend the day studying lichens.
Yes, indeed. They don't move from place to place. They don't change from season to season. And you can spend hours learning just about anything about lichens. Just need patience and a 10x hand lens and my book.
And the book again?
It's The Lichens of Ireland and Great Britain, A Visual Guide. And I'd like you to know, Terry, that it's Ireland and Great Britain. We're so used to books in this country being Great Britain and Ireland. So here we have an Ireland and Great Britain book.
Thank you, Terry and Paul. Again, all the details can be found on the website, rte.ie/mini. These are our gift ideas to you. Maybe you want to buy somebody a book that will inspire them to pay more attention to the natural world. Niall Hatch is next.
My Christmas choice, it's a slightly unusual one. It's mm-hmm. it's a field guide, and it comes from a bit left of field. It's maybe a left of field guide, I don't know. and it's not a, it's not actually an Irish book. It's not even a new book. You didn't say we had to have a new book.
No, I didn't.
It came out in 2019. There's been followed up by various sequels and so on, but it's really worth reading. I got a real laugh out of it. It's a humorous book. It's by a gentleman called Matt Cracht. He's the author and the illustrator, because there's some very, I suppose, unique, I won't say beautiful, but very unique illustrations in this book. And it's called The Field Guide to Dumb Birds of North America, published by Chronicle Books.
Dumb Birds of North America?
Yes.
Niall,
yes.
I'm surprised at you.
I think I can relate to Matt here, because I've been, like him, been obsessed with birds all my life. And honestly, though I love them, they do my head in sometimes. They can drive me nuts. And I think he's taking his frustration out on it. So what he's done is he's produced this field guide, which it gives you some interesting facts about these birds, but it's done in a very irreverent style. A lot of the language in it, the new names, he has new names for all these birds that many of them we couldn't say on the radio. I know it's after the watershed, but even so, my mammy would kill me if I just swear.
No, don't. But I did have a former boss who said there was no watershed on radio.
So now the format of this wonderful book mm-hmm. is that, there's an introduction explaining what a bird watcher is and what birding is and why it's different from bird watching and so on. And then it talks a little bit about what you need to do to be a bird watcher. And then the bulk of it, it's a very irreverent description of various species that you find in North America, these bird species, given new, maybe not so radio friendly names and descriptions about why they're so dumb and why they annoy the author so much. So quite a different approach, but actually I really liked it because it makes the facts stick in your mind in a different way, because you're remembering all these bad things about these birds.
All right, so you spoke to Matt Cracht. Great name. Where does he live?
He's based in Tacoma, Washington. So not Washington, D.C., Washington State in the Pacific Northwest. A place I've been lucky enough to visit a couple of times. Wonderful bird watching there right in the Pacific Ocean, that region of Washington. Not too far, I suppose, from the Canadian border over that side. Interesting place.
It's, this is a term I just learned. It's called humor nonfiction. Apparently that's the genre as far as bookstores are concerned, but it's a nonfiction book. And I grew up watching birds like you probably did. And I know here in the Pacific Northwest in the U.S., it's just kind of part of the culture. Everyone grew up with a bird guide or two, a Sibley's, an Audubon, a Peterson's, I suppose it'd be Collins, where you're at. And there was always one of those on the coffee table. Everybody had it. And nobody was serious about it when I grew up, at least nobody I knew. But I was fascinated by natural sciences. So I guess I would say that the book is for people who are interested in birds. It's formatted like a bird field guide, but it's a humorous take on it. I would also say that the facts that I've included are all real, but the opinions are all mine.
You say a field guide, but have you ever actually encountered anyone using it in the field?
People, actually, I have fans who have sent me photos of them using it while they watch birds. How much value it is, I'm not sure, in the field, but it's about small enough to stuff in your jacket pocket. So I encourage everybody to take it with them. You never know when you're going to see a scarlet teenager or the eastern kingbutt.
Indeed. Here in Ireland, we sometimes get some of these North American birds that come across the Atlantic as vagrants that turn up here accidentally. It's a very good place in Europe to see some of those birds. But I would genuinely say that the fact that the people here in Ireland and elsewhere in Europe may not be familiar with some of these species, it doesn't diminish the impact at all. I did find it very humorous. Just in terms of the actual species in there, do you have any particular favourites? Could you maybe give us an example or two of a bird that is particularly dumb and what makes it so dumb?
Sure. Do you want me to do a short reading? I'll pick one that isn't too salty. There's a bird named the Western Meadowlark, and I've named it the Western Meadow Jerk. And I simply say, look at this jerk singing his heart out. The Western Meadowlark is a medium-sized iditarod bird, whatever that means. It builds its nest on the ground in open grasslands, which proves it's stupid. If you can fly, then why the hell don't you just build your nest in a tree where it's at least safe from dogs? Plus, it's the state bird of like six states you wouldn't want to live in.
The thing is, as I was saying earlier, while you're laughing at that, you're learning as well, because there's quite a few memorable things you're saying about the bird there that will stick in people's memory. I think that for a lot of birders, they'll relate to it, they'll know about it. But maybe for people who are starting out, it really does sort of focus the mind on some of the key traits. You're giving a message about these, to be honest, remarkable and very beautiful meadowlarks.
Yeah, I didn't set out to write an educational book. I was doing three things that I really enjoy doing, and that's writing, drawing, and not being serious. So initially, when I started this project, it was kind of more for me and my friends than anyone else. But I do, I am interested in the natural sciences. And while I'm not a professional, I have a lot of respect for people in the sciences. And in the course of making a book like this, I'm taking some general knowledge that I have and doing research to find out more about them. And there's a, you know, birds are really fascinating creatures. Most creatures are, but I think they're ubiquitous. I mean, there are very few places on the planet where you can live and not see at least some birds. And so, you know, and humans have been living with them for as long as there have been humans. So I guess what I do is I lens their behavior through the eyes of, if they were humans, they would be obnoxious. But I think that's the humor in it, is the view that this author character is taking.
Another bird in it that really stuck out to me, because I particularly like your illustration of it, it's a bird that I, until now, would have always called the Eastern Kingbird, which has been recorded in Ireland, but you call it the Eastern Kingbutt. Could you possibly maybe read that section for us if you have it to hand?
Yes, the Eastern Kingbutt. This big-headed dope looks like he's wearing a business suit. A medium-sized songbird of eastern North America, this kingbird is notable for his stiff, upright posture of self-importance common to many business types. And then I give an identification tip here. Dark gray upper parts, crisp white throat, chest, and abdomen, with just a bit of cuff showing at the tail. Probably heavy starch. He thinks he's better than you.
Another one that stuck out that listeners here may be familiar with is a bird called the Canada Goose. What did you call it in your book?
I called it the goddamned Canada Goose. Thanks a lot, Canada. These f***ers are often considered a pest species. Why? Because of their depredation of crops, their noise, droppings, aggressive behavior, and habit of begging for food in urban parks, not to mention that incessant honking and their long, stupid necks. Basically, everything about these geese just makes you want to choke them. Goose tips. Feeding the geese at the park? Be aware that they can become overly aggressive in large groups. If you have to fight, don't let them surround you. Keep moving and try to take them on individually or in small groups.
See, I love that, because I think that there can't be a birder out there who hasn't encountered a group of geese. And in Ireland, Canada geese are feral birds in some areas. You do get some wild visitors as well, but they are incredibly frustrating birds and they do seem very aggressive. I think you've summed it up there absolutely perfectly. It sticks in the mind. Yeah, so goddamn Canada goose, I get it. I like that you blamed Canada for it as well, the very, very American attitude.
Yes. Well, this character is very American for sure.
Well, Matt, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a really great read. A perfect gift for anybody who has a bird watcher, a bird obsessive person in their lives. So the Field Guide to Dumb Birds of North America. Great for an alternative take on the well-worn field guide genre. And maybe we can write the European version together. Let's do that.
That sounds great, Niall. Thank you so much.
Sounds like an interesting idea indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Niall Hatch. Richard Collins, tell me about your choice.
Derek, the book I have chosen is entitled The Most Perfect Thing, Inside and Outside a Bird's Egg. Its author is Tim Burkhead, who was Professor of Behaviour and Evolution at the University of Sheffield.
I was watching a wildlife television programme, and the presenter, much loved and respected presenter, gave this spinning like a top explanation for the guillemot's egg shape. And that spinning like a top explanation had been dismissed 100 years ago, so I was a bit shocked. And as somebody who's been preoccupied with educating students, the idea that somebody on television, incredibly influential, could misinform the public kind of touched a nerve with me. It made me think, well, actually, nobody's really looked at why guillemot eggs are this shape. So I started to look again. And the key study was published originally in German with a very brief English summary. And people had used that English summary. So I paid a German-speaking colleague in the university here to translate the whole paper. It was a nightmare because it was a huge paper and it cost a fortune. But it revealed that the experiments that had been conducted by this Swiss ethologist, Beat Chans, and his colleagues, were not quite as robust as the summary statements seemed to imply. And it made me realise that here was a research opportunity. We could start to look at this seriously in a bit more detail and with the benefit of many, many more years of kind of knowledge and methodology and so on. So that was the starting point. If you're going to do that, you have to know a lot about eggs. So I started to read widely about eggs. And then I kind of realised that nobody had ever written about eggs from a biological perspective. And there was a good reason for that. The idea of people collecting eggs, for most of us, is anathema. So basically, the topic of eggs was what I call the forbidden area of ornithology. So some conservation organisations won't even publish a photograph of an egg or a bird's nest because they're so terrified that this might cause a resurgence of egg collecting, which it won't, of course. And in fact, when I wrote my book, part of my motivation was to try to break through this kind of cultural roadblock that said you don't study eggs. So there is a huge resistance to eggs. And really my motivation was to show people that eggs were wonderful, the most perfect thing, fascinating, worthy of study, lots of questions still remaining to be answered. And so that was the motivation for writing that book. The reason for focusing to some extent on guillemots is that I've studied guillemots since the 1970s. I'm passionately involved in guillemots, and they have the most extreme form of egg and coloration of egg of any species, certainly in Britain. And so it was a perfect combination of those two things working together.
Why do some birds lay only one egg while others lay several?
What you're asking relates to what's called Lack's hypothesis. David Lack was the 20th century's greatest ornithologist, and I was fortunate to have him as my supervisor, at least for a few months before he unfortunately died. And Lack's main research interest was precisely the question that you're asking. Why do some birds lay one egg, whereas something like blue tits lay 15 or 16 eggs? And the answer is that birds are designed by natural selection to produce the maximum number of offspring that they are capable of doing, which is usually determined by the food supply available to the chicks. Something like a great auk, which we have an egg here, they just laid one egg. That is because the food that that great auk chick needed was a long way out to sea, and the maximum number of chicks that a great auk could safely rear was one. If you're a blue tit living in a bit of oak woodland surrounded by caterpillars on the oak leaves, you can easily raise 12, 13, 14, 15 chicks. And so each species has evolved a reproductive rate that maximises its output. So that's why you have differences between species in the number of eggs that they lay.
You mentioned blue tits there. Now, the subject that comes up is calcium. Mm-hmm. If you lay one egg, you will get by on the minimum amount of calcium that you need to collect for the egg. Whereas if you're going to lay 10 or 12 eggs, you're going to have an awful lot of calcium to collect. And calcium is a sort of scarce commodity, I gather, in birds generally. Doesn't this offset the advantages of, or does it?
I think if birds had been incapable of finding enough calcium to produce 16 eggs in blue tit's case, then it wouldn't have evolved. In something like a seabird, like a guillemot or a great auk, they're digesting fish and digesting all bones. There's no shortage of calcium. And in fact, these two species, great auk and guillemot, lay the thickest shell relative to egg size of any bird species. That's because the egg is laid on a bare rock surface and it gets knocked around a lot, so it has to be very robust. If you're a blue tit looking to produce the calcium for a clutch of 16, you have to find snail shells or some other similar source of calcium. And they seem to be very good at that. And one of the questions I pose in my book is, how do birds find calcium? And I've asked calcium physiologists this question: can you smell calcium? And I think perhaps you can. I mean, it would be a very easy thing to test in captivity. You know, you just hide calcium at the time when birds need it in little boxes, and some would be controls and some would be experimental with the calcium in there, and you could tell whether the bird was capable of smelling it. Certainly if you kept birds in captivity during the breeding season, they have an appetite, a real appetite for calcium right at the time when they're forming the shell. And what something like a blue tit would do would be to go around on the woodland floor, find broken snail shells or sometimes fragments of bone, and they pack their gullet with calcium the night before they're producing the egg, because the shell would then be made the next day.
The cliffs of seabird colonies are white, more or less, from calcium, are they?
There's a lot of calcium excreted by seabirds. They probably ingest too much because, as I say, they're digesting all the bones.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard Collins and Professor Tim Burkett. Fascinating stuff. And then there was one. Me, my choice. I'm choosing somebody I've known quite literally all of my life. I grew up a few doors from this man. Now, if you're my age, you will have watched him on the den. And if you had kids, they probably watched him on the den. They certainly saw him on television or heard him on radio. And if not, they had his books. It's Don Conroy. I spoke to him at his home in County Wicklow, and he began by telling me about his latest book, which is called Drawn to Nature.
As you know, drawn to nature. I've been drawn to nature since I was about 6 or 7. So this book has been in the back of my head for quite a while. You know, I planned at some stage to try and do it, and lo and behold, it all happened this year. Not only am I drawn to nature, and I have been over the years like your good self, but I wanted to get people to be out there and looking around, because we live in such a crazy world now where everybody's so stressed and that. I think it's important that people take time to be a little bit more reflective, relax, and just enjoy what's around them.
So looking at the book, Don, you're really taking people on a journey through nature, and then you stop and you reflect on something. Now, normally when you're speaking with an author who's produced a wildlife book, they always mention their wonderful illustrations done by so-and-so. But actually, you're not just writing the words, you're also doing the illustrations. And that's what most people know you for, as an artist, first and foremost.
Yes, absolutely. It's something I love doing. And I've been drawing since I was 4 years of age. Every day I draw maybe a little doodle or whatever. I always have a pen in my hand or a pencil.
Now, who's it aimed at? Is it aimed at children? Is it aimed at adults? Is it aimed at the family? Who?
Well, actually, it's really aimed more at the family. And, of course, the people who grew up watching The Den and listening to you and me on the radio and stuff like that. So it's a very personal book. And I just hope that people will just sit down and dip in and out of it. There's some poetry in there. There's some reflective thoughts when I'm outdoors. When you're on your own, out in nature, you're in a sort of solitary situation. And in the solitary situation, sometimes nice thoughts come to you. William Wordsworth said once that poetry is emotion reflected in tranquility. And I think we need to allow ourselves time to be a little bit reflective, because everybody's, as I said, and you know yourself, so busy all the time. We're not allowed almost to relax. But I think you should give yourself permission to get out there and enjoy what's around you.
But it's not a field guide.
It's definitely not a field guide as such. I'm including a lot of my favourite birds and animals and areas which I've seen and been inspired to do a sketch, later on maybe do a painting. So it's almost like a meditative walk. In the Buddhist tradition you have the walking meditation, the sitting meditation, the standing meditation. Now, I'm not a Buddhist or anything, but I'm just saying all these lovely things we can draw upon. And it's like in the Christian terminology, contemplation of nature. Or, as I said, for the secular world, just to get out there and take a good breath, relax, and just look around you. I mean, there's a beautiful world right around you. It can be in your garden, if you have a garden, or it can be a walk along with a river, up the mountains, whatever it may be. Even looking at trees and things like that. I remember the late John Moriarty, and he was saying to me that he and we were out in the woods together. And he said, you know, the last person I brought into this woods, they never met the woods. And I said, what do you mean, John? They came in with all their information. They left with the knowledge that, you know, they were right about this plant and this bird and this tree. And he said, they never met the woods. And you know yourself, sometimes when we've been out recording something, sitting in the silence, just listening, waiting to hear that sound of a long-eared owl or the woodcock roding. You know, those magical moments, even just before we do the recording, you know.
I remember one time being out with you, Don, and you said that a fox could walk into an area, put its nose up into the air, take a good sniff, and know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's like reading a newspaper for the fox. They know whether there's somebody going around with a shotgun, they can smell the steel, but it's very faint now, so they must be gone. And of course, dogs are the same. You see dogs sniffing all over the place, you know, and they're getting all this information, you know. Amazing. But that's the beauty of it. You know, the fun of being out there with maybe with your dog or just walking or with somebody and just enjoying it, looking at the lichens on the trees, being surprised by the beauty of a little clump of primroses, seeing the first snowdrops. It's enchanting, you know. You don't have to be a Harry Potter to understand and enjoy the magic, you know.
Pure magic, Don. Pure magic. Don Conroy's book is called Drawn to Nature. And you can find details of all the books we featured in tonight's edition of Mooney Goes Wild on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. As Don Conroy said, there's a wonderful world out there. Maybe it's time for you to enjoy it.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day and the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do?
They're really saying, I love you.
I hear babies cry.
I watch them grow.
They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney. And Derek and the team will be back at the same time next Monday night. Up next, it's a late date with Cathal.
Email mooney@rte.ie.